Welcome to the debate. Imagine you are flying a massively complex aircraft.
Okay.
Naturally, you trust the instrument panel, right? You look at the dials for altitude, speed, heading. You just assume that if those dials are in the green, well, the plane is flying safely.
Right, because metrics give you a simplified, actionable version of a very complex reality. You absolutely need that level of abstraction to operate the machine.
But imagine looking at an instrument panel that says your altitude is perfect, your engines are generating record power, while outside the window the wings are literally shearing off.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a problem.
Right? The dials are flawlessly measuring the performance of the engines, but they are completely blind to the structural integrity of the aircraft itself.
It's a terrifying scenario, but I agree. It perfectly captures the diagnostic disconnect we are dissecting today.
Exactly. So today, we are examining a profound critique of modern civilization presented in Dr. Bihara Sahale's academic white paper, Beyond the Midas Trap: A Life-Coherent Framework for Monetary Financial Capture and Protection of the Life Ground.
It's a heavy title, but a crucial text.
It really is. The core thesis here is that modern civilization is caught in what Dr. Sahale calls the Midas Trap. We all know the myth of King Midas, right? He starved because everything he touched turned to gold.
Right.
Well, the paper argues this is now a systemic reality. We have built a foundational disorder where financial abstractions, things like debts, property rights, corporate returns, they are protected more reliably than the living conditions from which all real value actually arises.
And the central question that emerges from this paper is, frankly, monumental. Should we completely restructure our financial architecture to prioritize what the paper calls life capacity over claim sovereignty?
And I will be arguing that we absolutely must. The monetary financial capture of the physical living world, what the author calls the life ground, is an existential threat. Our survival literally requires subordinating financial claims to the continuity of ecological and human life.
And I will argue that while this paper correctly identifies some very severe systemic stressors, treating financial abstractions like debt, rent, and legal claims as inherently pathological is a fundamental misdiagnosis. These mechanisms are the tools that allow complex societies to function.
Even when they destroy the foundation?
Well, if we replace objective financial constraints with a highly subjective metric of, life value, we risk dismantling the very coordination systems that sustain modern society.
Let's start by looking at this Midas trap, not just as a metaphor for personal greed, but as a mechanical, systemic diagnostic.
Sure.
The paper draws heavily on the philosopher John McMurtry's work, specifically highlighting a fatal inversion in how we create value. Think about a healthy system, right? Money is just a tool to facilitate the exchange of goods to expand life. You use money to buy food, build homes, create medicine.
Right, the traditional utility of currency.
Exactly. But we have shifted to a sequence where money is advanced simply to return as more money, completely bypassing the physical reality of life. McMurtry calls this the M to M plus sequence.
Well, then if the definition of financial investment, yes, you deploy capital to generate a return.
But look at how it generates that return today. The system systematically converts living realities into assets. A thriving forest is converted into timber, which becomes an asset. That asset is securitized into a legal claim.
Mm-hmm.
That claim demands a yield, and generating that yield consolidates power. The paper calls this state claim sovereignty. The legal right to extract money is sovereign, and the physical reality of the living world is completely secondary.
I see where the paper is going with this, but...
Just to finish the thought, a financial system that generates its highest returns through extracting debt from the working class, speculating on basic housing, and depleting topsoil is fundamentally illegitimate. Why? Because it destroys the life ground, which is the absolute prerequisite for any economy to exist in the first place.
Look, I don't dismiss the severity of the ecological and social crises we're facing, but I have to defend the function of the claim system here, because I think the paper fundamentally misunderstands its utility.
How so?
Abstractions like property rights, debt contracts, and conventional financial stability, they aren't just, idols we worship blindly. They are vital technologies of social trust.
How is a system that demands infinite growth on a finite planet a technology of trust?
Because a debt contract is essentially a time machine. It coordinates human action across time. It allows a community to build a water treatment plant today based on the credible promise of tomorrow's productivity. Attempting to forcibly subordinate these tested, objective legal structures to an undefined, constantly moving target like life capacity is incredibly dangerous.
Dangerous in what way?
Think about the constraints of our current system. You know, margin, risk pricing, creditworthiness. These are the guardrails. If you remove them to serve a vague moral imperative, you remove the barriers that prevent complex societies from devolving into total chaos and catastrophic misallocation of resources.
Okay, but to understand why those specific guardrails might actually be driving us off the cliff, we have to look at the actual mechanics of money creation, because the paper argues that the allocation of credit is the root of the issue here.
Fair enough.
I want to pause here and make sure we don't gloss over this, because it challenges how most of us are taught the economy works. The text leans on the economist Richard Werner's credit creation theory of banking.
Yes, the empirical reality of how banks actually operate.
Exactly. We have to discard the textbook myth that banks are just intermediaries. People think, you know, a bank takes deposits from savers, holds them in a vault, and then lends that exact money out to borrowers.
Which is mathematically false.
Right. It is false. As the Bank of England itself has confirmed, commercial banks literally create purchasing power out of nothing when they issue a loan. They don't move existing money. They just type numbers into a deposit account. They originate credit.
Yes.
And right now, we allow private banks to direct this newly created money largely toward asset inflation. They create money to fund private equity leverage buyouts or to speculate on existing real estate. They are not creating credit to fund life capacity, like regenerative agriculture or critical infrastructure. That is a democratic scandal.
Look, Werner's mechanical observation of double-entry bookkeeping is entirely empirically correct. Commercial banks do originate loans which create deposits. The mechanics aren't in dispute. But the paper's proposed solution, what it calls Pillar 2, credit for life capacity managed by robust public banking, is highly dangerous.
Why? Why is it dangerous to direct newly created money toward things that keep humans and the planet alive?
I come at it from a different way. Democratizing or politicizing credit allocation under the banner of life capacity replaces decentralized market pricing with centralized moral judgment.
Centralized moral judgment.
Yes. When private banks allocate credit today, they are constrained by a very specific reality test. Can the borrower generate a return and repay the loan? That is a brutal test, yes, but it is an objective one. If you shift to a system where public banks or political committees allocate credit based on moral criteria, deciding what qualifies as life-serving, you invite massive capital misallocation.
Even if the alternative is ecological collapse?
Markets, for all their flaws, process millions of pieces of distributed information to price risk. A committee trying to finance what the paper calls the civil commons does not have that information processing power. They will fund inefficient, unviable projects, which leads directly to inflation and corruption.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because a circulatory system that feeds a tumor while starving vital organs cannot be called healthy, no matter how efficiently the heart is beating.
I'm not sure a tumor is the right analogy for economic growth.
But it fits perfectly. How rational is your market's reality test if it happily creates endless, frictionless credit for a firm to execute a leveraged buyout, strip a functioning company of its assets, and bankrupt it while simultaneously the exact same system claims there is a false scarcity of funds when a municipality needs to replace lead water pipes?
The market is pricing the likelihood of capital returning with a premium.
Right. But it isn't pricing risk efficiently. It is pricing the extraction of yield from the life ground. The market sees the tumor as highly profitable. If the allocation of our society's future purchasing power is left entirely to private profit maximization, we are guaranteeing the continued depletion of the living world.
But the risk of starvation you mentioned actually brings us to a critical part of the paper, how we handle systemic crises. The author utilizes a concept called a disturbance primitive Think of it as a stress test. How a system reacts to a severe shock tells you what it truly values.
Yes, the hidden hierarchy of rescue.
Right. The paper claims that when banks fail, governments instantly mobilize infinite liquidity to save them. But when households fail or towns are wiped out by disasters, suddenly the government enforces austerity. The language shifts to tight budgets and fiscal responsibility.
Exactly.
The paper frames this as proof that the system values claims over life. But this fundamentally misunderstands macroeconomics. Rescuing the payment system and maintaining investor confidence is how you protect households at a macro scale.
By bailing out the people who caused the crash?
By preventing contagion. If we let the claim system collapse simply because it fails some moral test of life coherence, the resulting financial contagion would instantly evaporate the margin of the working class.
But
let me finish. The savings, the pensions, the institutional trust, it would all vanish. The banking system is the nervous system of the economy. You don't let the brain die to teach the body a lesson about morality.
That's an interesting point, though, to frame it differently. If modern monetary theory, or MMT, reveals that currency-issuing states face real resource constraints rather than household budget constraints, why do we enforce austerity on public health and ecological repair while continuously expanding the monetary baseline for asset stabilization?
MMT is a highly contested framework, but go on.
Well, MMT points out a basic operational reality. A government that issues its own fiat currency cannot run out of money. The actual constraint on government spending isn't tax revenue. It's the availability of real physical resources, labor, steel, concrete.
Right, inflation constraints.
So if MMT reveals that currency-issuing states face real resource constraints rather than household budget constraints, why do we enforce artificial austerity on public health? When the financial sector needs a bailout, the central bank magically discovers infinite liquidity. The deficit doesn't matter. But when we propose a transition away from fossil fuels, suddenly we are told the nation can't afford it. The system stabilizes the claims of the creditors, while the physical ecological foundations beneath them literally crumble.
Let me stop you there, because MMT proponents and the author of this paper often conflate a mechanical truth with a free pass. Yes, a sovereign issuer of currency cannot involuntarily default on debt denominated in its own currency. They can always print more. But the constraint, as even MMT economists will tell you, is inflation.
Which is tied to real resources.
Exactly. And that explains the discrepancy you're pointing out. The reason a central bank can mobilize trillions in liquidity to rescue a banking system during a panic is that a financial panic is inherently deflationary. The velocity of money collapses, credit freezes. The central bank is simply filling a massive hole in the money supply to prevent a 1930s Tsao depression.
While enriching the asset holders.
Regardless of the distributional effects, mechanically, it doesn't cause immediate hyperinflation because it's replacing vanished credit. Now, contrast that with what this paper suggests using sovereign money creation to aggressively fund unlimited ecological transitions or subjective social programs without a corresponding immediate increase in productive output.
It wouldn't be unlimited, it would be tied to capacity.
But if you do that, you will hit real resource bottlenecks immediately. You will trigger massive inflation, and inflation is a highly regressive tax that absolutely destroys the purchasing power of the poorest citizens. Financial discipline isn't a myth designed by greedy creditors. It is the vital mechanism that protects the working class from the hidden tax of inflation.
But that purchasing power is already being consumed. It's just being consumed by structural dynamics that conventional economists refuse to measure. Let's transition to what economist Michael Hudson calls neo-feudal finance and rentier capture, which is really central to this paper's thesis. We have to clearly define the difference between profit and economic rent.
A distinction that is notoriously difficult to make in practice.
But conceptually crucial. Productive contribution builds life capacity. You manufacture a solar panel, you build a house, you provide a service. Economic rent, on the other hand, is merely toll gating. It's when you extract income not by creating anything new, but by controlling access to a necessity. Think of a landlord who buys up existing single-family homes. They aren't creating new housing.
They are placing a toll booth between a family and their basic need for shelter.
They are providing capital liquidity to the housing market.
They are extracting rent. And this is everywhere. Speculative housing turns shelter into an asset class. Intellectual property laws turn life-saving medicines into monopoly rent. Algorithmic tech platforms turn human attention into data yield. The paper argues we must aggressively de-implement this rentor extraction. Instead of marketing closures, we need to look to frameworks like Eleanor Ostrom's shared life goods financing, where shared life goods like water, health, and basic knowledge are governed collectively without a profit-extracting middleman siphoning off the value.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. I understand the frustration with rent-seeking behavior, but I think the paper's solution is a recipe for institutional paralysis. You say we need to de-implement renter extraction. Who exactly decides where productive contribution ends and renter extraction begins? Empowering a political authority to make that subjective distinction will freeze the economy.
It's not subjective when the extraction actively degrades human life.
Let's use your own example. Intellectual property. You call it a monopoly rent on life-saving medicine. Yes, a patent on a pharmaceutical provides a monopoly for a period of time. But let's look at the mechanism of how that drug comes to exist. Without that legal claim to future yield, who is going to invest the billions of dollars and decades of research required to develop an mRNA vaccine?
Publicly funded universities already do most of the basic research.
But who commercializes it? Who is going to finance the construction of new housing developments if their property rights and their future rental claims are subordinated to a constantly shifting, politically defined standard of life accountability? If you try to completely flip the foundation of how we value things, overnight what you might call an ontological reversal, you will freeze private investment. Capital simply will not deploy into a system where the rules of ownership are entirely subjective.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. If we accept Steve Keen's warnings on private debt dynamics, isn't it true that unearned rents are forcing households into unpayable debt just to access basic shelter? At what point do we implement debt jubilee pathways before the entire system fractures under structural violence?
Keen is right that high private debt is a source of macroeconomic fragility. I'll give you that.
It's more than fragility, it's structural violence. When housing is treated as a speculative asset before it is treated as a shelter, the price of the asset inevitably rises faster than wages. So what happens? Households are forced to take on massive mortgage debt just to put a roof over their heads. This creates a fragile pseudo-prosperity.
Right, the debt burden grows.
The GDP goes up, the banks look profitable, but the underlying reality is a population slowly drowning in debt obligations they can never realistically repay. Johann Galtung coined the term structural violence to describe systems that harm people implicitly without a person pulling a trigger. When the math of the financial system dictates that the debt cannot be repaid without destroying the physical and mental life capacity of the debtor, we have to act.
And the paper suggests, what, just canceling it?
The system fractures under its own weight. A legal debt claim should only be considered legitimate if its repayment remains compatible with human life.
A debt jubilee sounds incredibly appealing and deeply moral, until you examine the actual mechanics of a balance sheet. You can't just wave a wand and erase debt. Every single liability in the financial system is someone else's asset.
But usually the asset of a massive financial institution.
Not just Wall Street banks. If you arbitrarily cancel household debt or mortgage debt because a committee deems it a burden on life capacity, what happens mechanically? Those mortgages are bundled into securities. Those securities sit in the portfolios of firefighters' pension funds, municipal governments, and life insurance companies.
What?
If you wipe out the liability, you simultaneously wipe out the institutional wealth that pays for retirements and community services. Yes, Steve Keen's math on private debt is a valid warning, but the solution is careful macroprudential regulation. We need to slowly deleverage over time. You cannot execute an abrupt systemic default branded as a jubilee, and you certainly cannot dismantle the objective constraints of the claim system in pursuit of an idealized life value sequence without destroying the incredibly intricate machinery that coordinates global survival.
But the machinery itself is currently programmed to consume its own life support systems.
That's a dramatic framing.
It's the reality of the Midas trap. To summarize my position on Dr. Savely's paper, I think this debate highlights a terrifying reality. Civilization cannot escape the Midas trap by merely growing richer in monetary terms while becoming poorer in life. A rising GDP that reflects debt-fueled speculation, ecological depletion, and the monopolization of basic human needs is a false progress.
Right.
We have developed a financial lens that sees liquidity, inflation, and asset prices in pristine high resolution. But that exact same lens renders the exhaustion of workers, the destruction of topsoil, and the foreclosure of future generations entirely invisible. The highest realism is not protecting asset values at all costs to save the balance sheet. The highest realism is ensuring the viability of the life ground. If the economy requires the disposability of life to function, then it is the economy that must be redesigned, not life that must be sacrificed.
And to summarize my perspective, I fully acknowledge the profound moral and ecological questions raised by this framework. The paper provides valuable analytical tools for understanding where the system is under stress. But dismantling the claim system is not the answer. Property rights, objective debt enforcement, and market-priced credit are not arbitrary toll gates designed by cartoon villains.
Nobody is saying they're cartoon villains.
Incentives manage scarcity and coordinate action across billions of people, subjecting the entire global financial architecture to an undefined, highly subjective standard of life ground stability would destroy the predictability required for complex social organization. We must reform the system from within, using the tools of targeted regulation and taxation, rather than attempting a foundational reversal that risks tearing down the pillars of modern civilization just to see what grows in the rubble.
I appreciate that perspective. And I think where we do find strong convergence today is in the recognition of the dangers of unchecked asset inflation. Neither of us thinks the current speculative bubbles are healthy.
Absolutely not.
We also clearly agree on the absolute necessity for greater monetary transparency. As the paper points out, a democracy cannot meaningfully govern itself if its citizens do not understand the mechanical reality of how money is created and where credit actually flows.
Completely agreed. Transparency is a prerequisite for both functioning markets and functioning democracies. The public must understand the mechanisms of the systems they participate in, rather than relying on outdated textbook myths.
There's so much more to explore within Dr. Sahali's framework, particularly the specific diagnostic matrix provided in the text, to help identify exactly where financial claims have superseded life capacity in our local communities. It forces us to ask deeply uncomfortable questions about what our society actually values when push comes to shove.
It certainly challenges the foundational premises of modern macroeconomics, and regardless of where you fall on the solutions, it is a debate that requires rigorous continued scrutiny.
Let's bring it back to where we started. We are staring at an economic instrument panel with dials that read perfectly. Stock markets are hitting all-time highs. Liquidity is flowing. The GDP is growing. But outside the window, the structural integrity of the aircraft we are flying in, the living Earth, and our social fabric is under immense strain. The question we leave you with is this. When the dials say one thing and the wings say another, which reality do you trust?